A new TV show called Black Jesus is causing consternation among some Christian groups. It premieres today on Adult Swim, the late-night lineup on the Cartoon Network. The live-action comedy is the latest project from Aaron Magruder, who's best known as the creator of The Boondocks comic strip. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, Black Jesus is obviously designed to push buttons. She talked with some theologians about their response.
Yolanda Pierce is a minister and a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary. She sat down recently to watch a preview of Black Jesus. Here's what she was thinking.
I'm bracing myself, right?
Pierce knew the show's set in contemporary South Central Los Angeles.
Jesus!
And it presents a Jesus roaming around a neighborhood filled with liquor stores, mini-marts, and people praying for help.
I need the numbers to the lotto.
The lotto numbers?
That the best you can ask, man? I mean, there's folks out here dying of famine and pestilence, and you want the lotto numbers. Come on, man. You can do better than that.
I did like it.
Pierce says the show's concept raises real theological questions.
If Jesus were to return, what would Jesus look like? What would Jesus do? And would we, those people who consider themselves as Christians, as I do, recognize Jesus if the historical Jesus is not the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus of our usual stained glass depictions?
What is it with that guy?
You want a beer? Oh, I love y'all so much.
Baby, that's Jesus.
How could this show not be provocative? With a Jesus who drinks 40-ouncers, curses, and smokes weed. Yolanda Pierce says maybe it reflects the reality of people who could use some ministering to.
Especially people at the margins who may be using weed or who may be drinking as a way to soften the brutality of their everyday existence.
Pierce says Jesus would preach to the people Scripture calls the least of these. In Black Jesus, they're bums, ex-convicts, even nerds.
Who made Google, Trey?
Sergey Brin and Larry Page.
But who made them, Trey?
He messing with you, man.
No, the parents made them.
God made them, Trey. Right. I mean, you feel me?
Yeah.
The theological questions are well and good, but the broad humor of Black Jesus does not entirely convince Juan Floyd Thomas. He teaches African American religion at Vanderbilt University's Divinity School.
It's kind of disconcerting. It's kind of jarring seeing this Black Jesus with a long perm, you know, and dusty tan robes walking through South Central LA.
Floyd Thomas appreciates how the show's first few episodes examine how Jesus might deal with police brutality, surveillance, and contemporary racial strife. But he says he's not yet seeing a program quite as good as Aaron Magruder's earlier comic strip and show, The Boondocks, that he says grappled with deep social questions.
Specifically to African Americans to talk about, okay, what are we doing? What is at stake here in terms of collective responsibility or communal self-regard and self-respect?
Both scholars emphasize that Black Jesus is not a new concept. It's an idea that's been associated with Black nationalism and explored on TV shows such as the sitcom Good Times back in the 1970s.
Jesus was Black, the Bible would have said so.
But it does say so.
What are you talking about?
It's in Revelation chapter 1, verse 14. I read about it in Muhammad Speaks. His hair is like wool, and his eyes are like flame of fire.
The idea has been explored more recently by musicians, including Tupac, Kanye West, and The Game.
Yeah, young Black Jesus. You know why? 'Cause I'm the young Black Jesus. Yeah.
We create Jesus in our own image.
Professor and minister Yolanda Pierce says Jesus can withstand, even absorb, pop culture interpretations. Jesus has been a hippie in the 1960s, a culture warrior on South Park and in Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. So, she says, it's not a stretch for Jesus on Adult Swim to turn cheap beer into fine cognac.
Is this the only way I can get y'all attention, man? Come through with a little yinnack.
Just like in the Bible, Jesus gets annoyed with his disciples.
I come through spitting the gospel all the time, man, but y'all ain't trying to hear you, boy, though. No, y'all ain't trying to hear me. So you know what? I don't even think I want to let y'all hit this fine yak because your minds ain't ready and your heart's not open.
You have this appeal to this notion of our better selves, right? How can we possibly be our better selves?
Scholar Juan Floyd Thomas says it never hurts for the question to be raised on screens and bedrooms and living rooms outside of church. What would Jesus do? Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Jose Gomez was born in Mexico. He grew up to become a Catholic priest and moved to the U.S. Now he is Archbishop of Los Angeles, and he's been thinking for years about immigrants who fill the pews.
we can be a beautiful example for the whole world. What Los Angeles is now is the way the world is going to be in my mind, with the movements of people.
People speak more than 40 languages in the Archdiocese, which says it serves 5 million Catholics. Taking office in 2010, Archbishop Gomez confronted a sex abuse scandal. Now he wants to focus on a long-standing passion, immigration. He wrote a book on it, quoting both the Bible and Thomas Jefferson. When we visited his office, he said he wants generous treatment for Central American children now crossing the border.
It seems that sometimes we see these young immigrants coming by themselves as a threat for our country, when in reality they are just looking for safety and for a place where they can grow up as a normal, healthy, and good and strong members of society. I think our concern in the church was that we will send them back right away without really giving them the opportunity to study their situation.
In fact, the government is moving to send them back more quickly. That is the tendency of the administration, and there are some in Congress who want to go much further. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I'm really disappointed. We had that piece of legislation from 2008, supported by President Bush.
And the legislation that said that children should be given due process before.
That's correct. So I think it really makes sense to study the cases of these kids coming, because they are basically refugees. Yes, it is a challenge for us to have more of them coming here, but that's our responsibility in the world. And we have refugees from all the Middle East countries and other countries in the world when there is this situation of violence and poverty.
What do you say to critics of illegal immigration who would suggest that their moral case really is quite simple? There's a law, it's being broken by people across the border, send them back.
It is true that in this country we respect the law, and it is important to make that point. But the circumstances in which they live and they come are not just because they want to come here for no reason. And we need to take that into account. Maybe the solution is to facilitate somehow their process of getting the documents, and maybe have a penalty because they broke the law. And maybe the penalty can be some kind of community service.
If people paid a penalty such as community service or a fine or whatever it might be, would they ultimately get what they wanted by breaking the law, though, because they would get to stay?
I don't think that's what they want. They don't want to break the law. They come here because they want...
But they want to stay. That's what their goal was.
Yeah, but what is the reason for which they broke the law? Because they wanted a better life. And they are not doing anything bad. They're just coming to this country to provide for their children, to have security, to make a contribution to this society. The bishops of the United States, we always have said that the immigrants are a blessing for this country.
How does your personal life story affect your beliefs on this issue?
My mother grew up in San Antonio, Texas. She graduated from high school there. And her family, on her mother's side, has been in what is the United States now since 1805. So I guess at that time was Spain, and then it became Mexico, and then the United States of America. So that's the reality, especially that area, northeast Mexico and southeast Texas. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of geographic reality that the cultures are together. I have family in Mexico. I have family in Texas. So we are the same. We are men and women, children, brothers and sisters, and we want the same thing, to really make life better.
You make another interesting point in your writings, in that you say that you understand that some people are fearful about the future of the country and that they want to protect the country. But then you write, the dream of America as this country was founded is not the reality anymore. What did you mean by that?
I mean by that that the openness to the basic values of this country, like faith, family, work, to have a comfortable life, it's becoming more and more difficult to have a society that supports that, in my view.
How does that relate to the immigration debate?
It relates because a lot of these immigrants identify themselves with those values. That's what they want.
Let me raise one other thing, Archbishop. People in Los Angeles will know that you replaced an archbishop whose tenure was overshadowed by scandal, which you have had to deal with in the early years of your time here. How has the aftermath of the sex abuse scandal affected your ability to speak out on other issues like this one?
Well, no, it's obviously the sex abuse scandal was a tragedy for the church in our country, and we always have tried to support the victims and tell them how horrible that was. And we have an extraordinary program of protection of children in the Archdiocese, with more than 1 million kids that already went through the training program, and also maybe 250,000 or so adults that have been trained in order to do all they can to protect children. And we're very sorry for everything.
But I'm thinking about the fact that you are speaking out on this vital national issue, and you're speaking on behalf of people you see as needing help, and in fact, specifically speaking on behalf of children who need help. And you must know that some people's minds, when they hear the reference to the Catholic Church today, what they will think of is that scandal. That is part of the national dialogue at the moment.
Well, I think in the Catholic Church, we help people. We have done that for 2,000 years. I think we have a good record in that sense. I think people understand that we want to do what is best for families and for children.
Archbishop Jose Gomez, who spoke with us at his office in Los Angeles.
The late Gabriel Garcia Marquez once said that the inspiration for his books came from daily life in his region. Surrealism runs through the streets, he said in an interview in 1973. Surrealism comes from the reality of Latin America. The story I'm going to tell you today is one that could be ripped straight from one of his novels. It has a criminal, his lover, her lover, a murder, a court case, and a medium. This is a story about Brazil. But it begins in the least romantic place you can imagine, a tiny office in an old building in a rural city called Uberaba, northwest of Sao Paulo. Rondon de Lima is a lawyer with a wide, wolfish grin, slicked back silver hair, and the dapper dress sense of a man more suited to a Paris cafe than an agricultural city. This tale begins, as many do, with a relationship gone sour. In this case, her name was Lenira de Oliveira. Her man was a crime boss, the head of an illegal gambling operation here.
Ela era uma pessoa extremamente apaixonada por João Eurípides Rosa.
She was very much in love with João Rosa, but he couldn't be only with her. It was her and two, three other women.
Oliveira started seeing another man, an ex-cop.
But João Rosa, although he had other women, he doesn't accept losing Lenira.
He is consumed with jealousy. One night he follows Lenira Oliveira and her new boyfriend. A shootout ensues, but it is the crime boss and not the lovers who is killed. The ex-cop and Oliveira are charged with murder. And this is when things get otherworldly. Lenira is riven with guilt. She still loved him, you see. And so she goes to see a medium, a very famous one. And she receives a letter from João Rosa, the gambling kingpin from the beyond, de Lima says.
O recebimento dessa carta por esse médium.
In the letter channeled by this medium, the deceased confesses. He says his jealousy was the reason for his death. The letter includes details that only people close to him could have known.
And this letter is then submitted by the defense to the court to exonerate the accused. Let me repeat that. A letter channeled by a medium, supposedly written by a murdered crime boss to his ex-lover, is admitted in a Brazilian court of law.
My name is Herta Helena Hollenberg Padilha de Oliveira. I'm judge.
Judge Herta says there are many cases involving spirits in Brazil.
If the proof is not illegal, is lawful, you have to accept it in the process.
So if I come with a letter written by a medium from a dead person purporting that this crime wasn't committed or saying that I wasn't the person who did the crime, the judge has to accept it.
He has to accept the proof in the process. He can't say, take the letter away from the process. In the process, no, he can't.
Why do you think this happens here in Brazil? Do you think it's because Brazil is a more spiritual society?
Of course. This is it's a very spiritual society. It probably 19% of the people probably will believe in something, in some kind of a spiritual influence. And most of the people believe in life after death.
Life after death is one thing. Being able to communicate with the dead is another. But it's an accepted practice in Brazil. To understand why, you have to delve into a religion called Spiritism. Brazil has more practitioners than any place in the world, almost 4 million and growing. And as it happens, its center is the city where the court case took place, Uberaba. We arrive at a modest building in a residential neighborhood where a service is being held. It's 5 a.m.
Here this morning, 80 people are huddled on this cold, rainy pre-dawn day under blankets in a sort of chapel. In the front of the room sits a man writing letters.
His name is Carlos Baselli. He's the main medium here, and he channeled the letter used in the recent court case. So, briefly, if you're thinking Victorian table rapping and seances, then actually you aren't far wrong. But this isn't at all your neon sign advertising a palm reading for $5. This is a religion. No money changes hands. Spiritists believe in reincarnation, but also in Jesus' gospel.
Right now, some of the associate mediums are coming around to the congregation and laying their hands on them, and it's supposed to be transferring spiritual energy, this all to the tune of feelings.
It's suddenly my turn. A woman waves her hands over my head and upper body. I don't know if it's the power of suggestion or the music, but I feel a buzzing. All eyes are now on the podium. Baselli starts to read out the letters he has channeled from the dead. One in particular catches my attention. It has a lot of detail.
E a verdade é que eu havia me excedido no shopping.
The spirit explains that he was drunk when he was hit by the car that killed him. The letter details exactly how it happened. As the message is read, a group of people next to me begin to cry. Gisele Fernanda Bardassi tells me her husband was run over by a car 4 months ago. Next to her, one of her three daughters quietly sobs.
It is my first time here. I was desperate. I wanted to know what happened. It was a big question because we were together and suddenly we found him dead on the road.
The letter, she says, has given her comfort. At the end, I ask Carlos Baselli, the medium, if he remembers the letter he channeled that was used in the court case.
No. Sincerely, I don't remember. The letter is given, and the way the family uses it, if they keep it, throw it away, or rip it, we don't know.
Baselli says he believes that letters should only be used as a last resort in a legal case. They are written to comfort the families and sometimes even bring a little clarification. Baselli was trained as a dentist, but he's been a medium since his youth, when he started having out-of-body experiences. He explains that he never knows which spirit will speak through him or why.
Eu não sei como ele vai terminar uma frase.
I don't know what the spirit will say. For example, I don't know how he will end a sentence. Sometimes he is writing and I'm thinking, how is this sentence going to be finished?
Back at the lawyer's office, Rondon de Lima tells me he used the letter because it's not the judge who decides a criminal case, but the jury. And he says everyone in the city believes in the spirits and will take a letter like that seriously. In the end, the lovers were indeed acquitted. But was it because of the letter? We'll never know. De Lima says there was overwhelming evidence, the forensic kind, that the ex-policeman acted in self-defense. I ask him if he believes that these letters from the dead are real.
Se eu acredito nessas cartas, perfeito? Eu confesso que sim. Eu confesso que sim.
Do I believe, he says? I confess, I do. Preservation of Yiddish as a spoken language gets a lot of attention, but it once also had a vibrant written tradition. Plays, poetry, and novels all were published in Yiddish until the time of the Holocaust. A great deal of these works can be found at the National Yiddish Book Center in Western Massachusetts. John Kalish reports.
The National Yiddish Book Center was founded by Aaron Lansky, who began his efforts to save Yiddish books in 1980 while enrolled in a Jewish studies program at McGill University in Montreal.
I started putting up notices in the Jewish delicatessen and laundromats in the Jewish neighborhoods, you know, that I'm a young grad student, I'm looking for books.
Lansky was surprised to learn that the offspring of Yiddish-speaking immigrants were throwing out large quantities of old books.
I'm racing around the city on a bicycle, and the piles in my apartment are getting higher and higher, and my teacher came over one night, and we started going through these piles, and we realized, oh my God, these are some of the greatest treasures of the Jewish people, and they're just here for the taking.
Large numbers of Yiddish books were first published in the 1500s. They were mostly aimed at women and poorly educated men who couldn't read Hebrew. In the late 1800s, there was an explosion in Yiddish publishing. Lansky says that in addition to translations of Tolstoy and Shakespeare, there were political tracts, science texts, and fairy tales translated into Yiddish. There were also short stories and novels by writers such as Shalom Aleichem and S. Ansky making up the Yiddish canon.
It embraces all the great themes of all modern literature. The conflict between the individual and the collective, power and powerlessness, sexual awakening, I mean, struggles for social justice, war and peace. There's very little that you won't find in the pages of Yiddish literature.
The National Yiddish Book Center's headquarters is located on the campus of Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. It is a light and airy structure that recalls a wooden synagogue in one of Eastern Europe's shtetls or small towns. The oldest books are stored in a climate-controlled vault on the lower level. Newer books are upstairs on shelves. Books are still being published in Yiddish today in the U.S., Israel, Europe, and South America. Sebastian Schulman coordinates the center's program to translate Yiddish books into English.
In Yiddish, you say, reingefallen in a Schmalzgrube, and that means fell into a bucket of fat. You hit the jackpot. And that's really what I felt what happened when I got into Yiddish.
The National Yiddish Book Center pays people to translate a small number of Yiddish books each year. It has a website called Teich, where a community of 200 translators discuss the origins and meanings of Yiddish words and phrases.
We have one user who's a native speaker of Pennsylvania Dutch and really knows the sort of Germanic component of Yiddish, but he's weaker on the Slavic component of the language. And so we have users from Russia and Ukraine who chime in and say, well, this is what this means in Slavic.
The center is also publishing books. A Holocaust memoir written by a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto will be the next release.
Rachel Auerbach became the only one of all the writers of the Holocaust to be able to base her memoirs on her own wartime writings.
Auerbach was a journalist who escaped before the ghetto was liquidated. Aaron Lansky says her notes were buried for safekeeping and retrieved after the war. She used them as the basis for a two-volume memoir.
These are an absolute unique document. They came out in Yiddish in Israel, had a very small readership, and were quickly forgotten.
Most of the center's books have been digitized. 11,000 titles are available online for free. The center says they're often downloaded by people living in religious Jewish neighborhoods like Brooklyn, where Yiddish is still widely spoken. But many secular Jews connect with the National Yiddish Book Center as well. Every summer there are programs for people who want to read important literary works or learn to speak Yiddish.
Wenn Shabbos Kodesh kommt zu gehen, was sagt man?
25-year-old Michael Yashinsky works at the Detroit Opera House and dreams of staging a Yiddish play someday.
It's not just about dusty pages. It's really what can be found in those pages and making it relevant to Jews of today or to anyone today who's interested in this amazing culture that flourished in Yiddish land.
The National Yiddish Book Center shares books with libraries around the world, including the National Library of Israel. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.